This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. A lot of stand-up comedians come on stage in conventional clothes, jeans, or maybe a suit. It's their material which is shocking and scandalous. Then there's British comedian Eddie Izzard, who dresses in drag and talks about toast.
Toasters! Ah, toasters are good. Like them. Like toast. It's got a toaster there, but it's got a turny dial knob thing on the side. And it lies to us. It does not tell the truth, for it has numbers from 1 to 6, and they lie. You set on 4, you put bread in on 4, and boom, comes up 3. 3. This is 3 toast, no good at all. Hardly done. You set and change to 5, you put, comes up 6. This is 6, all burnt. Scrape. Oh, it, forget it. Because the toast is in there going, stay down, lad, stay down. Stay down, go for the burn. No pain, no gain. No fish, no fowl. No socks, no shoes. No hair, no haircut. And the other toast going, what the hell are you talking about?
Eddie Izzard's new one-man show, Dressed to Kill, is running off-Broadway at the Westbeth Theatre. He's a cult figure in England, where Channel 4 television once celebrated his birthday by proclaiming it Eddie Izzard Day, scheduling all his favorite movies and TV series, including The $6 Million Man. John Cleese of Monty Python, one of Izzard's idols, calls him the funniest man in England, maybe on the planet. His one-man show, Dressed to Kill, is basically full-speed-ahead stand-up comedy, a mixture of skits about anything and everything from British imperialism and the Anglican Church to the American space program and Star Trek. You have a sketch in Dressed to Kill about Engelbert Humperdinck. And after a bit, you say very seriously, it was sad, though, that you just heard on the news that Humperdinck died in L.A. yesterday. And you get everyone going, everyone believes this, and then you say, no, he didn't, you're all so gullible. And you go back and forth. You have people, yes, he did, no, he didn't. You have tremendous control over the audience. How did you learn to command that kind of control over an audience?
That's through street performing. Yeah, that's you learn to manipulate the energy of a crowd, which sounds kind of floaty and sort of
new agey.
But yeah, but it is true. An audience has an energy, and it can be all over the place, or it can be quite, and if you're a good performer, you can knit it together as a tight thing so that they react as one. And the street performing is so experimental because you constantly have cats and dogs and cars driving through your show and drunk people walking through your show and police telling you to move on, and it's just and the weather stuff rains on your head or snows or there's wind, or so there's a lot of natural ad-libbing happening, or natural forces happening against your show. So you just learn to be able to deal with anything. After street performing, you can deal with anything.
How do you handle heckling? Do you try to take it as a challenge to work the heckling into your act?
No, heckling is just another... I've analysed heckling enough to know that it's not really a problem. I've done far too much performing for them to be able to do anything to me. And it's basically the best position to adopt if you're being heckled as a performer is a hugely arrogant one. And which is quite fun, being able to play arrogance or just be incredibly arrogant, because it's not normally a very socially acceptable position to adopt. But if someone starts challenging your show, then you can just tear them apart, because they will never have had as much experience as you've had on stage. So they challenge you, and they think it's you against them. But in fact, the whole audience, if they're with you at this point, is your gang. So they're on your side. They want you to win. And in fact, most hecklers, 90% of hecklers, are actually just trying to help you or trying to feed the show. Unless you're actually on stage and dying thunderously and having a really bad time, and then hecklers come in and attack.
You say right at the start of your new show that you're a male transvestite and you fancy women. You're a tomboy. You're a male lesbian.
Who said that? God, that's all... Yes, that's absolutely true. What did I say? Male tomboy. Yeah. Male tomboy or male lesbian. Male lesbian explains and confuses at the same time, which I like because it's kind of like washing powder. It washes and it cleans. It dries as it hangs, as it flips over. Yeah, because most male transvestites do fancy women, I believe, I strongly believe now. Because there's distinct link-ups, a lot of sexuality traits which go together. And in the alternative sexuality era, so if you're gay, lesbian, or TV, a lot of people hate using the word transvestite because there's very negative connotations on it, but I'm actually reclaiming on that word. But TV is the shortened version of it, or cross-dresser. But in fact, there are no cross-dressers because, I mean, transvestite just is Latin for cross-dresser, so why we should go around using a Latin term, I do not know. But, you know, there are no women transvestites, are there? Since the 20s, women have successfully removed the term transvestite from our social dictionary. Don't you think?
Absolutely. There's no meaning.
It has been totally removed. Whereas back in the 20s, it would have been used if we went back in a time machine or looked in history books. It was used as reference, and they had women doing male impersonations on stage in vaudeville. They definitely did in London. And now it's gone. So that's great. Women have total clothing rights, and I think men have total clothing rights if they want them. They're just sitting there to grab. So I grab them, and I wear whatever I want, and it has nothing to do with my comedy.
How do you choose what to wear?
Well, I go into a choice section part of my brain, and I have little gates that go yes or no, and I go through all my clothing, and I go yes, no. Oh, how do you choose where you wear clothes? I just choose by the normal thought processes. There's no big deal. And how do you choose where you wear clothes? You just how you feel, yeah?
Right.
And it's that kind of thing.
Well, thank God. No one looks at me when I do my work. I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah, when you go on stage, well, then it sort of, does this go with that and this and I end up in this sort of tomboy area-y kind of... I don't know, I keep trying to move it around. Clothes are just clothes. They're just bits of cloth. Just wear them. It doesn't matter.
When you first came out... Some people, when they first come out, they have a female persona. They give themselves another name when they... when they dress as a woman or whatever, put these clothes on. Did you do that?
Well, sort of. There was an idea, because I would be... because I said male lesbian, because I'd be quite happy to be a woman, but I look very male-like, because when you hit your teenage period, I know there's coding going in, so... and everyone's, you know, up to puberty, girls and boys have a pretty similar facial shape, but then I've got into this sort of male jawline area, so it's I just look like a guy who wears makeup. So when I was, if I was initially when I came out, I was sort of trying to pass as a woman type thing, but everyone said yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir, getting in and out of taxis or whatever. So I thought, oh well, stuff this isn't gonna work. I'm very practical, in my approach to being getting this thing working for me. So I've come to a much more sort of tomboy area, and it's also it's much easier for me because I'm in the entertainment world. You know, if you're a lawyer, if you're a forklift truck driver, there's a lot of, because if you are transvestite, there's a lot of male in you. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of people in the army, a lot of people do very male jobs and are TV, and it's a tricky area because, you know, you're surrounded by a lot of people who are deep into macho and machismo, and so trying to express your feminine side is very difficult in that middle area, or trying to get to a middle area. But in the entertainment world, it's our duty in the end to find the way out. Because, you know, like Marlene Dietrich and Katharine Hepburn were the first women to really wear pants, and so get that whole thing going. And they were big movie stars, so everyone said, oh, if they can do it, then we can do it. And then it became a fashion thing, and that's the way it's got to start. So... you know, by the when we get in the 21st century, it's going to chill out, and everyone can wear whatever clothes they want. It'll take some time, but you know, it's much more positive these days.
I don't want to beat this to death, but I do have one more question. I'm just curious. when you decide to come out, I imagine you have to experiment a little bit first. Do you start very very
frumpy.
Discreetly or from
no frumpy. You have to go through frumpy transvestite. Well, it's somewhere between frumpy and over the top. You have to go through your teenage girl phase. You know when teenage girls first get access to clothing? Because there is a phase where I remember watching a sort of magazine daytime chat show type thing in London. in the United Kingdom, and there was a mother going on about her daughter. She was 11. She was wearing these high heels. She'd caught her own daughter wearing high heels and makeup, and I told her to get this stuff off, she was saying. And I thought, hey, this could have just been me, this teenage girl. That's what I would have gone through, because it's just fun clothing. That's why I think women who do want to wear heels and makeup and whatever, it's just kind of fun. And then when you go through the teenage girl phase where you go to your first disco and teenage girls just wear far too much and there's too much makeup and skirts too short and way over the top. And then in the 20s, when women get in their 20s, I feel they chill out and think, oh, I'm not going to wear this all the time. This is a real pain. And just, it's so laborious putting, you know, makeup is quite a... just fiddly to do, and so you'd just rather not wear makeup. So women in their 20s and their 30s, they just chill out and say, well, if I want to dress up, I can, but if I want to dress down, I can as well. And that's the phase I've got to now. So I started out and the heels were too high and the look was all wrong. And you have to also get a look. You have to be able to wear clothes so that you can have friends saying, oh, that doesn't work. Oh, that looked good on you. That doesn't work. And, you know, and I've got a kind of blokey male body, so I've got to say what goes with this and what doesn't go with this, and okay, my legs are better, all right, that's good, but, and you know, it's just trying to get my body shape slightly different. So, but then a lot of women have there's women who go through and men who go through lots of different facial looks and body shapes. There's women who are very mannish looking, there's men that are very feminine looking, and there's the whole gamut of range of looks are there, so you can always get a look that will work with you.
My guest is British comedian Eddie Izzard. His new one-man show is Dressed to Kill. He's appearing at the Westbeth Theater off Broadway in New York City. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with British comedian Eddie Izzard. His new one-man show is Dressed to Kill. It's appearing at the Westbeth Theater off Broadway. Your mother died when you were 6. Yeah. Did you develop ways of coping as kids do, have imaginary playmates or imagine conversations with her?
No, I started performing, I think, because of that. I mean, people do think, oh, your mother died. Oh, that means that's the transvestite link-up thing. But I don't think so, because I just knew I was TV before she died. But I don't know. I'm still open-minded about that. I think the key thing that happened was that the performing happened, because I wasn't really... I remember... doing a sort of school play. I was 6. I was a raven. My mother made me a raven suit. I'm glad I wasn't very good at this as a raven. And that's good because, you know, there's not a lot of raven parts around. And I wasn't that bothered about doing the show. But then after she died, I remember seeing a play and thinking, I've got to do this. And there was sort of applause going on. And I think it's a surrogate affection machine. Because my mum was there and she was very affectionate, and she disappears, and then the audience is there, and I have to perform. You know, it's quite good because you don't just stand there and they give you affection. You've got to go out and do your best, and if you're interesting, they go, "Hey, that's good," and then it sort of takes off.
Yeah, it's really the opposite of unconditional love.
Yes, it's conditional. It's very conditional, depending on the reviews.
You've acted on stage in London in Mamet plays and other plays. You have a movie coming out with Sean Connery, a takeoff on the Avengers, the old Avengers series. What's your role like?
I have the biggest role in the Avengers. It's really my film, and Sean agreed
cameos.
To be in it. I have a small role. Sean Connery's the bad guy, and I'm second bad guy, and I go around hitting people on the head, and I stare at them. And I hit them, and I chew gum, and I have a huge fight with Uma Thurman, who's Emma Peel, and wears a lot of very tight, rubbery type clothing, which looks very good on her. And my role is more supporting and helping them get their lines right and giving them cups of tea and stuff. But it's the Avengers, which not everyone knows them in America, but it was a great British cult. Kind of quirky, campy type thing. Camp in a good way, not camp in a... Camp in a sort of sassy, surreal and dry humour type way.
You have a really a physical presence, and your face is very expressive. Did you have to tone anything down to act on screen? I'm thinking that exaggerates, of course, every facial expression, especially in close-up.
Well, I don't do comedy roles on television, so it's totally different... beast, really. I approach it a totally different way, and I don't Yeah, I don't pull big old faces. Hey, look, I can do wide mouth frog impressions.
You don't want to be cast as a funny in a funny role?
I don't do comedy roles, and I'm not doing transvestite roles, because everyone's come and say, hey, comedy transvestite, here, there's a comedy transvestite role. And I'm just going, no, I'm just going to play straight roles, straight dramatically and just ordinary orthodox sexuality area. Later on, I can play a transvestite role when I've found the right one or whatever. But and comedy, I don't play comedy, because my comedy is... I was very influenced by Steve Martin, and... I just listened to his CD again, early CDs of stand-up, and if you hit in this area of kind of crazy, surreal stuff, people just want to see you do that. They don't want to see you do anything, any straight role, because the hits of comedy are just so buzzy that you don't want... You can't wait around to get the slow feel, the slow burn of someone who's bringing a character... to a screen over, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, you get drawn into believing in this person as being a real person.
Eddie Izzard, I want to thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thanks very much.
Eddie Izzard's one-man show, Dressed to Kill, is running at the Westbeth Theatre in New York.